should. So in this case, Francisco is asking about, well, he's posing an argument that I don't know that he thinks this, but he's considering this argument anyway,
right,
where tattoos and earrings would not help us. Well, they might not in particular cases. And in those cases, I would say, well, then definitely don't get them. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean they intrinsically do us no good, because let's take the case of earrings. Well, you know, a lot of times, especially as, you know, a younger man, perhaps Psychella, you might have seen a woman who was wearing earrings at a party or something, and they were attractive and enhanced her beauty.
Yeah, sparkly, shiny. Yeah. That's how I was when I was young.
Yeah, so... So in that case, they would be doing something good for her. They would be helping her look attractive.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and earrings, we're talking about pierced ears in this case, because clip-ons don't affect your body. But I mean, if you have clip-on earrings, they're not, you know, altering your body. But if you had pierced ears and you then wore earrings that enhanced your attractiveness or signaled your religious identity or did any number of other potentially beneficial things, then the argument that Francisco is considering wouldn't apply to them. What about tattoos? Well, certainly there are tattoos that people can get that will not help them out. You know, you get Dancing Satan tattooed on your arm, that's not helping you out.
Right.
At least in most circumstances. But that's not going to apply to all tattoos once more. In fact, in various Eastern Catholic and Eastern Christian traditions, it's common to have a little tattoo of the cross sometimes on your hand, but elsewhere also possibly, as a way of reminding yourself of your Christian identity and of your need to use your body for God's glory, as a way of signaling that you are a Christian to other people. And so in that case, the tattoo would definitely be doing you some good. So I would say, Francisco, that there's no one-size-fits-all rule here. It doesn't qualify. Tattoos and pierced ears under ordinary circumstances do not qualify as mutilation. And whether or not it's advisable to wear particular earrings or get particular tattoos is going to depend on the nature of the case. Some of them would not benefit you, but others could.
Thanks, Francisco. I appreciate that very, very much. It does seem like we get that. It does seem like...
comes up a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The tattoos one.
The tattoo one. But it also seems like it's related to the fact that there's just more and more people getting tattoos. And I wonder...
Maybe you know this.
Is this a cyclical thing? Like, has there been, like, in 1840s, everybody was getting tattoos? Or is this just a... Maybe the technology got to the point where it's very convenient now.
One of the things about social trends and fashion, which is really what this is a matter of, is fashion.
Yeah.
One of the things about fashion that sociologists have noted is that they tend to rise and fall in cyclical waves, like a sine wave. And that happens with baby names, you know, which are fashions.
Right.
It happens with hemlines on dresses.
Right.
It happens with facial hair on men. It happens with tattoos as well. Back in the World War II generation, for example, there were a lot of men who had tattoos. My grandfather was one of them. In my generation, not nearly so much.
Right.
But then in the generation that grew up after me, a lot more again.
Yeah.
And so you can expect fashion trends to play out like that. And there are reasons for that. One of the reasons is people in the middle class frequently, at least historically, will imitate people in the upper class. And so when the middle class starts imitating, and, you know, people tend to imitate the class above them, whatever that is.
Right.
So, for example, when middle class people start imitating upper class fashions, the upper class people need to do something else
to show that they're,
that they're upper class.
Ah.
And so, but there's only so far you can go with fashion. You know, there's only so long or so high that hemlines can be. There's only so much or so little facial hair you can have. And so that's what creates the, or at least contributes to these cyclical fashion waves.
Ah, that makes a great deal of sense. Francisco, thanks very much for the question. Let's go to Trent in New York, listening on Catholic.com. Were you where all the rain was there in New York, Trent?
Yeah, I was. Thanks for taking my call, by the way. But thankfully, my family and friends all made it through okay.
Yeah, lots of prayers for the folks in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. It's really wild what happened. Go ahead, Trent, with your question.
Okay, so Jimmy Bar Jimmy, my question is, do you believe that there is any evidence to suggest that angels are derived from Zoroastrian traditions, or at least typical Christian conceptions of angels, such as, you know, them having names and personalities, or guardian angels, could those be derived from Fravashi?
So the evidence that I'm aware of would indicate that Hebrews had concepts of angels prior to encountering Zoroastrians. Zoroastrianism is a religion, for people who may not be familiar, that is that was actually historically very common. Today it's much rarer, but it's still around. But it's native to Iraq, to modern Iraq or ancient Mesopotamia. And it has some similarities with Christianity. Now, sometimes you'll hear Zoroastrianism characterized as dualist, to where you have like two equal and opposed gods, one good, one evil. That's really not the case. Zoroastrianism actually is monotheist. It believes in one great god, and then he's opposed by a lesser being that is evil and who will ultimately be defeated.
Oh.
Now, does that sound like any other religions you can think of?
Yeah. I think I might be in one of those.
So when Jewish people at the time of the Babylonian exile began to encounter Zoroastrians, they talked with them, and it's like, hey, we're kind of on the same page about a bunch of stuff. And so there has been scholarly speculation that Zoroastrian ideas influenced some later Hebrew authors and vice versa. In terms of angels, I would say that the evidence is that Hebrews had concepts of angels long before they encountered Zoroastrianism, long before the Babylonian exile. And that's not surprising, because angels are basically mid-level spirits in the invisible world. They're under God, but they aren't, but they're superior to humans. So they're basically mid-level spirits. And, well, that's a concept that every culture has. Every culture has an idea of the spirit world with spirits of varying levels of power and authority in it. And so every culture has something equivalent to angels, whether they call them that or something else. In terms of could Zoroastrian ideas have influenced particular depictions of angels, either in the Bible or in Jewish tradition outside of the Bible, which then could have influenced the way Christians sometimes envision angels, it's not impossible, but I am not aware of any particular evidence for it. It's not a question I've studied closely. There might or might not be evidence for that proposition, and I would have to consider it open-mindedly, but certainly the concept of angels did not come from Zoroastrianism. That's not how Christianity or Judaism got the idea.
Thanks, Trent. We got to take a break, so I'll leave it there and hope that that was helpful to you. There'll be one line open now, 888-318-7884. More Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Yeah. here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. You don't have to be a woman to enjoy Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music for you on this Thursday afternoon in California. Maybe it's Thursday evening. Maybe it's a Wednesday morning, wherever you are. I have no idea why Brandon looks so mad. Is this some system not working in there, Brandon? It all seems to be going fine.
The groovy music worked.
Thank you very much for the groovy music. Hey, we've got the 20 Answers Challenge still on. We're really proud of these 47 books in the 20 Answers series. 20 Answers on all different topics having to do with Catholic apologetics. And you can get the whole set of them, all 47 books, 65% off right now at shop.catholic.com. The whole set, 65% off, shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, our guest, open forum continues. We go now to Midland, Texas. Ryan, our old friend in Midland, Texas, thanks for calling, Ryan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right, I want to ask, Jimmy, why does the Douay Rheims Old Testament list a third and fourth book of Kings?
Because it's an alternative numbering or alternative set of designations for some books that are in other Bibles. We have this sequence of six historical books, and in most Bibles today, they're called 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, and then 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And the first four of those, 1st Samuel to 2nd Kings, all deal with the monarchy in Israel. In 1 Samuel, we have the establishment of the monarchy with King Saul. Then we progress through to King David and Solomon and into the other kings. So because this block of four books all deals with kings, it in some versions of the Bible, including the Douay Rheims, they're all referred to as the books of kings. And so 1 Samuel becomes 1 Kings on this reckoning, 2 Samuel becomes 2 Kings, 1 Kings becomes 3 Kings, and 2 Kings becomes 4 Kings. And all of them deal with the history of Israel's monarchy, and so as a result, they all get called the books of kings in this reckoning. But really, 3 and 4 Kings are the same thing as what are called 1 and 2 Kings in other Bibles. It's just a difference of name.
Ryan, thanks. Thanks very much. We continue on. Very busy day, as always happens when Jimmy's here. Let's go to Thomas in Noonan, Georgia, listening on Catholic.com. Thomas, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Mr. Kellett, Mr. Akin. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to, Thomas.
I'm an agnostic, and I have a question concerning Catholics' belief of free will.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to pose it to you this way. Imagine my father said to me, Thomas, if you don't live your life the way I say you should, I'll kill you. If I obey him, am I doing it out of my own free will?
Well, it's going to depend on how you define the term free will. If you mean, could you have chosen otherwise, then yes, you would be obeying him out of free will. If you mean, did he exert any kind of influence? In other words, was this a freedom completely uninformed by any other considerations? Well, then no, it wouldn't be free in that sense. It's going to depend on what you mean by freedom.
Well, what I'm saying is, how do we have free will when we either have to choose between obeying God or going to hell?
Well, so one of the things that we need to bear in mind is that, as I said, there are different kinds of freedom, and it is not required for what most people would call freedom that it be consequenceless. I mean, for example, we regard America as a free country, but if you commit murder, you're gonna, and you get caught, you're gonna go to jail at the least. And the law is, that law is something that people are generally aware of. If you commit murder, there are gonna be consequences. But we wouldn't say that you lack free will because the law says that there will be consequences if you commit murder. It's still up to you to decide, are you gonna commit murder or not? And in the same way, if God says, you know, I've given you freedom, but here are the consequences, pro and con, to how you, to what will happen depending on how you use that free will. People would still generally say, well, okay, then you have free will. You have a genuine ability to choose what you're going to do, and it's an informed choice because you have knowledge of the consequences ahead of time.
That makes sense. Thank you.
No problem.
Thanks, Thomas. Really appreciate the call. Thank you very, very much. Sometimes lately I've been feeling like we invite non-Catholics to call, but not as many taking us up on the invitation. So it's very nice to have you make that call, Thomas. Let's go to Austin in New York, watching on YouTube. You survived the rain, Austin?
Oh, yeah. I didn't even know there was like this whole rain thing. My roof was leaking, so I was wondering what was up with that.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're all right. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. So let's say your whole life you go to confession and make it your business to confess mortal sins, and you die, but you forgot a mortal sin.
Mm-hmm.
Does that forgotten mortal sin merit purgatory?
Well, it actually, the answer is, there's not a single answer to this, because if you forgot a mortal sin and you didn't ever repent of it, you know, so it's like, oh yeah, I murdered someone, and you never turned your will away from that and said, wow, I shouldn't have murdered someone. I wish I hadn't done that. If you, even though it receded into the depths of your memory and didn't come to mind again before you died, if you still had knowingly and willfully murdered someone and never turned your back on that, never turned your will away from that act of murder, then you would not be saved. You would not go to heaven or purgatory. On the other hand, if you had repented and simply forgotten to mention it in confession, then you would have been forgiven of it. And whether there would be some purgatory that you needed to experience or not would be a decision that ultimately God would make, but your salvation would be assured either way, as long as you don't willfully hold back a sin that you've repented of in confession. Then you will end up being absolved, and there may or may not be remaining consequences that need to be taken care of in purgatory.
All right. Thank you.
Sure thing.
All right, Austin. Thank you. Thanks very much. Going to the Philippines now. James in the Philippines watching on Facebook Live. James, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, sorry, Jimmy. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. All right. Good morning. we're not quite to that morning yet. We haven't hit Friday morning yet.
From the future, that it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good.
You got one of those tachyon telephones from the Philippines.
Yeah.
Go ahead, James.
So I was just rereading Brand Petrie's Jesus and Jewish Ruth and Mary, and also our favorite Mama's Boy's book, Behold Thy Mother. And, I do accept that Mary is sinless, but I just can't connect that to her not experiencing birth pains. Mm-hmm. Is it something that we Catholics are required to believe? Is it a dogma?
No.
And what evidence do we have to...
Okay. So what Catholics are required to believe that is a matter of dogma is that Mary was a perpetual virgin, that means she was a virgin before the conception of Jesus, and at all points after the conception of Jesus, including when she gave birth to Jesus and throughout the rest of her life. Now, what that means in terms of what happened in the act of giving birth is something that is a matter of theology rather than a matter of dogma. And so theologians can and have taken different approaches to what happened during her act of giving birth to Jesus. And some have proposed that she had a miraculous birth that did not involve any pain, but others have said that's not required by Catholic doctrine. For example, the late Cardinal Avery Dulles indicated that. Yeah. And so one can take different positions on the question of did she experience pain in the act of giving birth to Jesus. That's not a matter that is determined by Catholic doctrine or dogma. In terms of, now you asked for evidence regarding why she might have a painless birth. And I would say that the evidence that I'm aware of, the earliest evidence that I'm aware of, dates to the first century. And there's a document known as the Ascension of Isaiah. I've done a careful study of the dating of this document. It looks like it was written in the year AD 67. So quite early indeed. And it records a tradition that Mary had a miraculous birth where Jesus passed through her womb in a big display of light without any actual normal birth process. And so since the birth process was circumvented in this case, she didn't experience any labor pains. And there are other early Christian documents that indicate the same thing. So that would be evidence of a quite early nature, of a quite early period that would indicate this. But like I said, it's not a matter of Catholic doctrine, and so it's something on which there can be a variety of opinions.
Thanks, James. Appreciate that call from Friday morning in the Philippines. We're going to continue with Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this. Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. 2 hours of open forum today. You can call about anything you'd like to ask about, and anybody can call, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you're welcome here. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and that usually means phones full, and it still means phones full.
Okay. Then let's do our best to empty some.
Let's try to empty them. Michael in Florida, you're next, watching on YouTube. Thanks, Michael, for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, in the book of Daniel, chapter 10, verse 5, mm-hmm. is it understood that the being that speaks to Daniel could be Jesus? And if it is, or does he appear anywhere else in the Old Testament in physical form?
Okay, so let's do the second question first, because it's a bit easier to handle, or can be handled a bit more concisely, I should say. There are speculations that you will find from the age of the church fathers onward about Jesus appearing in various Old Testament passages. And when God appears in nature, whether it's as a natural force or as something like the burning bush or as a person or a voice or whatever it may be, it's called a theophany, from the Greek words theos, meaning God, and Epiphanes, which means manifest. So a theophany is where God manifests in the natural world somehow. When Christ does it, it's often called a Christophany, for Christ manifesting. And there are various theologians and church fathers who have looked at different passages in Scripture and said, oh, I think this is the pre-incarnate Christ. I think this is a Christophany. And passages that they tend to do that for are ones where the angel of the Lord is said to appear, because at various points the angel of the Lord seems to be identified with the Lord, but also be distinct from the Lord somehow. He's obviously a high-ranking messenger coming from God, and Jesus is God's most highest-ranking messenger to the world ever. So there's some logic there. Another candidate that has been proposed, another passage that's like that, is in the book of Joshua, where the commander of the Lord's heavenly army shows up and in human form. And obviously, the commander of the Lord's army in heaven would seem to be maybe the highest ranking angel and or the highest ranking person in heaven, the highest ranking messenger to humanity. And so some people have said, I think the commander of the Lord's army may be the pre-incarnate Christ. So you do have these speculations. In terms of Daniel 10, I understand why one might suppose that it's Jesus speaking to Daniel. To read just a little bit from it, starting in verse 5 of Daniel 10, Daniel says, "I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like topaz, his face was like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice sounded like the sound of a multitude." Sykelet, can you think of any books of the Bible where Jesus is described in language strikingly similar to that? Maybe late in the Bible, maybe very late in the Bible.
Not Revelations.
Not Revelation,
but Revelation.
Well, Revelation, yes. So if you look in Revelation, there is a description that is clearly Jesus, that is very, very much like this. And so it could be reasonable to look at Daniel 10 and say, well, I think this is Jesus. So one would want to consider that as a possibility. And I think it is a possibility, but it also needs to, we also need to look at the passage and say, well, is there anything in this that would suggest it might not be Jesus? And if you keep reading, one of the things you find out is that this figure that is appearing to Daniel was delayed in getting here. Daniel had prayed 21 days earlier, and this is the answer to his prayer. And in verse 12, the being tells him, "Do not be afraid, Daniel, since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns times yet to come." And he goes on to say that once he leaves, he and Michael are going to trounce the prince of Persia, and then the prince of Greece is going to come after that. Now, what we're talking about here are the heavenly princes. These are the princely angels that God has put in charge of different nations, like the angelic prince of Persia, the angelic prince of Greece, and Michael, the angelic prince of Israel. So you have this conflict going on in the heavens. And an argument against this being Jesus would be the fact that the prince of Persia was able to stop him.
Yeah.
He wasn't able to get here on his own. He was detained by the prince of Persia, and he needed Michael to come help him. And so if you look in the passage, there are indications that could suggest it's Jesus, but there are also indications that would point against it being Jesus. And what opinion you ultimately come to will depend on your reading of the data.
Okay, Michael.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Open forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, 888-318-7884, our number. Now we go to Jonah in Williamsburg, Virginia, watching on YouTube. Jonah, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Where is the Garden of Eden?
I think the question was, where is the Garden of Eden now?
I think you said
now. And the answer is that I don't think there is a Garden of Eden now. The book of Genesis tells us some things about where it would be, and it would seem to be somewhere in the Middle East, either in the nation of Iraq or in one of the other countries that's near Iraq, or it might be in the Persian Gulf today. At least that's the basic location where Genesis would suggest it would be. It would be somewhere in that part of the world. But we have explored that part of the world, and if it's underwater, it's not a garden anymore because trees don't live underwater. If it would be a site that's on land, then we've explored all of those lands and we haven't found the Garden of Eden. So I don't think the garden is there these days. I don't think it's anywhere on Earth now.
Okay, Jonah?
Okay.
Jonah, how old are you?
Thank you.
Seven. You're seven. You did a great job, Jonah.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Okay.
There we go.
Jonah. Good job. Really good job. We got time. Let's go to Ryan in Wilmington, Delaware, watching on YouTube. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So I wanted to ask, so I've heard from online that from certain Jewish folks that that the early Christians distorted the Old Testament in order to fit the narrative.
Okay. Well, anyone can make any claim they want. That doesn't mean you need to entertain it seriously. Did they give you any arguments or evidence for this claim?
There wasn't any sort of evidence or anything, but it just got me wondering.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I would say no, Christians did not tamper with the Old Testament. Now, it's going to depend on what you mean by that. If you mean changed the text of the Old Testament, that's something nobody had the ability to do because there were lots of copies of the Old Testament scriptures in circulation, and they were spread all over the Mediterranean world because Jewish people, many of them, were living outside of the Kingdom of Israel, and so they were all over the Mediterranean basin and points farther east as well. I mean, that's one of the reasons St. Paul, because he's determined to always preach to the Jews first and then go to the Gentiles, but he says he's going to Spain. You know, he talks about that in Romans. He wants to go to Spain, which is about as far west as you can go in Europe. And he's expecting to find Jews there that he can evangelize. And we know there were. In fact, there were Jews even farther, like in the British Isles and so forth. So there were Jewish people with copies either in Hebrew or Aramaic or Greek of the Jewish scriptures all over the place. And there was no central registry of scripture copies that you could go to and search, you know, grab them and then forcibly modify them and put them back into circulation. So nobody, Christian or otherwise, had the ability to do a widespread change of texts to fit any particular agenda.
What do you think, Ryan?
Yes, thank you.
Ryan, I'll tell you what, if you want to hang on, Jimmy wrote a book called The Bible is a Catholic Book, which gives you a great introduction to where the Bible came from and how it got put together and all of that. If you'd like a copy of it, you just hang on and Thomas will get your information and we'll send you a copy of that. In the meantime, we have to go to a break. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Having a lot of fun. Jimmy Akin's here. How bad could that be? And then coming up next, Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, and it's open forum. Anybody can call with any question at all. 888-318.
I predict you will have a very relaxing next hour.
With Mark Brumley?
Yeah.
He's very mellow, huh?
He's very mellow. But I also predict you will not get through as many questions as we did this hour.
No, we will definitely not.
Yeah.
No.
I think Mark and I are both pretty mellow guys, but have some little different styles.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. There's some that we have a general, let's say, in the radio department, we generally know the speed with which each apologist moves.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you get through questions. Let's see. Ryan and who do we get? Where are we at? Detroit? No.
For Detroit or Florida would be fine. Sure.
Oh, well, let's do Luke in Florida watching on YouTube. We're coming to you, Jordan, in Detroit. Don't worry. Luke in Florida watching on YouTube. You are up next. Luke, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. I'm a big fan. Listened to your show a long time.
Thank you.
Question is that the Catechism says angels are spiritual, non-corporal beings, but there's scriptures that seem to imply angels have some sort of body. For instance, when an angel wrestles with Jacob, or when Abraham and Sarah offered an angel cakes to eat. So how are we to understand the bodies of the angels in light of what the Catechism says about them being non-corporal?
The way that this is classically understood is that angels are able to assume different forms in order to be able to interact with humanity because they don't themselves have physical forms. They're created intellects, and so they're non-corporeal, meaning they don't have bodies natively. But they can manipulate human perception, and they can manipulate matter. And so between those two abilities, they could either assume a visual form, even though there's nothing physically there in a particular case, and a human would experience, in essence, a vision of interacting with an angel. But because they can also interact with matter, they could also manipulate matter in order to come up with a kind of temporary body for themselves. And medieval theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas and others would talk about these as aerial bodies, because the idea was they took the matter that's in the air and they fashioned it to make a temporary body for themselves. And then when they were done using the temporary body, they would let it dissolve back into the air it came from. And this is something, if you had control of matter, you could do that. You could condense the matter to create a kind of temporary physical form for you, like an avatar. You know, it's not really you, but you're using it. And so you could have this temporary avatar body that you could then let go of and it could dissipate. According to different theologians, these avatar bodies or aerial bodies would have different degrees of functionality depending on the degree of control of matter that the angel would have. So a very powerful angel, now all of them as far as we could tell, would be able to at least imitate a human shape and make it talk like a human, so it could vibrate air molecules, you know, and generate speech and do basic other human things. A question that came up, though, is could it mate with a human being?
Oh, yeah.
And there have been various figures in the history of Judaism and Christianity who have said, yeah, that would be possible. And frankly, I don't know what the limits of angelic control of matter is.
Yeah.
But if they can make a body for themselves, maybe they could make a fully functional one. I don't know. St. Thomas Aquinas, though, was of the opinion that they couldn't. What his proposal was that they could appear as a type of angelic manifestation known as a succubus. They could appear as a woman to a man and have relations with the man in order to get the germ cells needed to make a baby, and then appear, this is an angelic manifestation known as an incubus, they could then appear as a man to a woman and transmit those germ cells in order to make a baby, but the baby would still really be the son of a man.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be half demon. At least this is St. Thomas Aquinas' opinion.
That is a lot of detail. So Thomas Aquinas got into that. Luke, I hope that's helpful for you. Thanks very much. Have they thought about how angels would manipulate matter?
The trouble is that we don't have a robust understanding of the forces that operate in the physical world,
because
we've been able to study them and measure them and test them. We don't have nearly the same level of study of this, of the spiritual world.
Yeah.
But if you look at what angels can do, they seem to be able to communicate with each other, mind to mind, because they're created intellects.
Right.
They seem to be able to sense things on Earth to interact with us. And they seem to be able to manipulate things on Earth without using a physical body. And so, so those three abilities, mind-to-mind communication, sensing things without sense organs like eyes, and manipulating matter without things like hands, have parallels in human history. They're called these days telepathy, clairvoyance, and telekinesis.
Oh, yeah.
And they are sometimes claimed by, for example, various parapsychologists to be abilities that humans natively have in their own nature to a weak degree.
Right.
And there have been Catholic theologians who have picked up on that and said, well, in fact, actually in the Middle Ages, there was this idea that, well, basically any ability an angel has, our spirits could potentially exercise when we're out of our bodies, at least. And so there have been even more recent theologians after the development of parapsychology, like the 20th century Swiss theologian Alois Weisinger, who wrote a whole book about this, proposing that that parapsychological phenomena are to be explained as the ability of human spirits to do things in exceptional circumstances. And his proposal was that if we had not fallen, we would have these, these would be the preternatural gifts, and we would have been able to do these things much more robustly.
How interesting.
And today, what parapsychologists are measuring are essentially the remnants of those abilities in our fallen human nature after the fall into sin.
That is fascinating. Luke, I'm really glad you called and asked that question. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, but telekinesis is the short answer. How they could manipulate matter. Yeah, telekinesis. How does telekinesis work?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought the answer was going to be the Higgs boson.
Well, it could involve the Higgs boson, but it would be the Higgs boson, for people who may not be aware, is
I'm among those people. I don't know what it is.
There are certain kinds of particles that carry forces. They're known as bosons. And the Higgs boson is involved in giving other particles mass. So there's this Higgs field. Different kind of mass. There's this Higgs, the proposal is there's this Higgs field that fills the universe, and the Higgs boson that involves mass and weight, to put it over simplistically. And the Higgs boson then couples that mass to other particles.
Wow.
And so it's possible that the Higgs boson could be involved if telekinesis is real, but it's not any physics we've discovered at this point.
The world is mysterious, Jimmy. Have you ever noticed this?
I've noticed that.
It is a mysterious world. Jordan in Detroit, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Si. Thank you so much for all that you guys do.
I'd like
to better understand what we mean. I'd like to better understand what we mean by how we can increase in righteousness after the initial state of justification. In other words, like at baptism, by like the grace of God, we're declared righteous, but we're also made righteous 100%. So like, how can we grow more righteous than 100%?
So in my book, The Drama of Salvation, I use a metaphor that I think can help shed light on this. And I say that as a bit of a pun because it involves light. Light has more than one dimension. You can have both a certain quality of light, but then you can also have a certain quantity of light. Now you can imagine, let's say, a tiny, teeny, tiny little light bulb that emits 100% pure white light. Okay, so it emits pure white light, but that light is not going to broadcast very far because it's just a teeny little light. It doesn't have a lot. It doesn't emit a big quantity of light, but it does emit pure light.
Yeah.
Well, then you could imagine a bigger light bulb that also emits 100% pure white light, but has more power. It's got more wattage, so it puts out more total light. And I think that's one of the best ways to understand, or as an analogy, what happens in justification. When we first come to God and are justified, He takes away everything that's truly and properly sin and gives us righteousness. And that's pure righteousness. So in terms of quality, that righteousness is already maxed out. But in terms of quantity, it is not maxed out, and it will continue to grow over the course of the Christian life as we cooperate with God's grace in different ways and do acts of supernatural love, which He then, He gives us His charity. We become more loving people. He pours more of the theological virtue of charity into our souls, and we become more righteous as we become more charitable people. Now, there's a debate in theology about, is the righteousness that we receive the same thing as the charity, or are they distinct in some way? And you have different theologians on different sides. One tradition would say, okay, the righteousness is technically something different than the charity we receive, but they always go together. So the more charity you have, the more righteousness you have. The other position would say, no, the charity itself is just the righteousness.
Okay.
And both of those are legitimate theological opinions.
All right, Jordan?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Jimmy. God bless you.
You too.
Hey, Jordan, you mentioned the Drama of Salvation to him, right?
Yes.
Maybe we could send you the Drama of Salvation. Hang on, and we'll send it to you if you'd like. Thomas will get your information. Chris in Normal, Illinois, listening on EWTN. You got to be quick if you want an answer. Can you do a question quickly?
I can.
What's your question?
Yes, please go.
Yes, my question is, why does God allow us to love others and have loving relationships with others, be it friendship, marital or family or otherwise, when he alone satisfies our longing for love, wouldn't it be better? Doesn't our love of others distract us from him? And wouldn't it be better if we were all just hermits, totally focused on him and no one else?
God's key priority is love. So you've correctly identified that. But God doesn't love us as individuals to the exclusion of other people. He loves other people too. And as a result, he wants us to love other people. And that means we need to have loving relationships with them. So just like God is able to have relationships with multiple people, even though he realizes he's the most important because he's infinitely good and he knows that, he's built us to also have relationships with multiple people. It is not good for man to be alone. He wants us to be a society and to be families. He wants us to love each other. That's why love your neighbor is the second great commandment. He's built it into us to both have relationships with other people and to have a relationship with him, which is one where we do need to recognize, okay, he's the most important. That's why love your God is the first great commandment. And so it's essentially an outworking of God's principle of love. And ultimately, all of the love we show for God's creatures implicitly is love for God, because he's the one who's responsible for those creatures being there and being able to have loving relationships with us.
Chris, thank you for asking your question quickly. I hope that that answer was helpful to you. Open forum will continue. Mark Brumley from Ignatius Press will be here to take your questions. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, there are lines open. 888-318-7884. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Tomorrow morning, new episode, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops.
And tomorrow afternoon, I'll be back in the second hour to answer more Q&A.
Oh, very good. Okay, great. We'll see you then, Jimmy. Thanks.
Okay.
All right, right back with more Open Forum and Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.